Well, welcome to week number 43 as we hurtle towards the end of the year. A really exciting time in markets is busy developing. Much more exciting than what we saw through kind of the middle part of this year. The S&P 500 for the week down 2.5%, NASDAQ down 2.6%, and the small cap index in the United States down 2.6%. If you go across into the UK, that's down 1.5%, and the Euro Stoxx 50 is down 0.25% for the week. Shanghai was up 1.16% for the week. The China A50 was up 1.7% for the week. Good news on the Rand front. The Rand broke through 19 and kind of settled at the 1885 level for the week. But there's obviously a lot of volatility as far as that is concerned. If we look across the bond world, US 10-year yields are at 484, US 20 yields at 521, and then short-dated US 2-year bonds are now at 5.01%. So certainly an interesting landscape that is busy developing. I suppose, Dawn, let's start with a big news item that has been in the news for the whole week and just, I think, dominates everybody's viewpoints at the moment. And that's obviously this unfolding war that's happening in Israel against the Palestinian territory. And just the ensuing world crisis that potentially could blow up or just blow in from this. I'm seeing more NATO backed ships and assets moving into the sea that they could actually do strikes into those areas from the actual Mediterranean Sea. I'm seeing that happening, and I'm seeing Israel being relentless as far as their Gaza interlude is concerned. I'm also seeing at the same time, I'm seeing a ground invasion that's busy happening. All of that is making for a very interesting space.
Not only that, Kobe, but what is happening is that sentiment is turning against Israel at this point in time. Even sort of moderate speakers are trying to say to Israel, you need to stop innocents in Palestine being killed in your counterinsurgency and this kind of thing. And, you know, it makes very, very difficult when you've got endless photograph of very young Gazians. Over 50% of the population in Gaza are children. When you see them suffering and they've got no water, they've got no food, they've got no fuel. The biggest protests that we've been seeing are actually pro-Gaza, pro-Palestine. And it's just the whole sentiment is being outweighed. I think it puts everybody into a bit of a precarious situation. And I mean, including people like us, and we don't want to sort of go and stick our foot in it. And obviously loss of any life on either side. But there just seems to be this feeling that even though, you know, October 7th was only 3 weeks ago, that people have forgotten about that. And that this is just Israel going in unprovoked, trying to annihilate Gaza. That narrative doesn't seem to be there, which I hope this ends in diplomacy. But I think it's just kicking the can down the road. They've been fighting each other for decades or centuries, let's face it. And when can it come right? And when you've got Gaza on the one side and Hamas, you know, some of these other Iranian-backed proxies saying that Palestine must be from the river to the sea, in other words, the Jordan River, Israel is going to cease to exist. And that is their, you know, negotiating standpoint. It's extremely difficult. It's extremely difficult. Mm. And as you said last week, there is the very distinct possibility that this could escalate, that you're already seeing Hezbollah getting involved. You can start seeing Iran directly involved. The Houthis that are, you know, in that sort of Qatar and south of Saudi Arabia, that they could get involved. I think this is one of the reasons that the Americans have mobilized into that area, is not really the Israel incursion into Gaza, but it's all those peripheral attacks that could escalate into a full-blown Middle East war.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, Dawn, because in the back of my mind, what I'm hearing people say, these are people in think tanks, people that have been thinking about the Middle East and have been doing work in the Middle East for decades, is that when Hamas had this full-scale onslaught on Israel, which really went beyond anything that they've done ever before in early October, they would have done so knowing that they were going to get backlash from the Israelis. They didn't do this just because they thought, well, there'll be no backlash. They knew there was going to be a backlash of some proportion. Now, they knew it was going to probably be full-scale, which is exactly what is happening at the moment. And the question is, to what ends? What if it was to save the Palestinian people from the onslaught that we're seeing right now? that obviously wasn't the objective. I think there was other objectives here. And those objectives are slowly, slowly will start revealing themselves as this conflict kind of carries on. And I think that's part of the reason why the Americans are in the territory. It's part of the reason why NATO has joined, because they want to be at the ready to see that what the next card that is being revealed, that they are at the ready to do something about this, wherever that might be and whoever that might be. What I'm seeing over the weekend is that governments now across the world are starting to take a harder line around this thing, which is exactly your point. It's all these protests that we're starting to see across the world. And governments are going to start taking a hard line, saying, listen, we can't support you we can't support them. And these are the reasons why we can no longer do so, because it's become politically unfavorable for us to do so, or because our people group and our country don't believe in what you're doing. And this has political ramifications. It has economic ramifications for the territory, and it has ramifications for across the world. I think this divides the West from the rest even more, and probably drives that agenda more and more as we continue. And Dawn, we'll really only see this thing, you know, in the coming weeks and the coming months, exactly what cards are revealed. And that is really speaking, I think, the end game here at the end of the day.
And we mustn't forget there's still a war going on in Ukraine.
Oh, yeah.
And the West doesn't have bottomless pockets. There's absolutely no doubt that Ukraine is going to come off second best as a result of this. And that's not pretty either. You know, I mean, when we were talking last week, the House hadn't elected a representative. They've now elected a representative. Yeah. You know, to quote Hillary Clinton, he belongs in that basket of deplorables. He's a piece of work. Yeah. He really is. Mm. You know, he's ultra conservative. He uses the Old Testament as his sort of moral guideline. Wants, for example, all abortion to be prohibited right across the whole country in much of the same way that it was places like Ireland and Italy and this kind of thing. So it's actually winding the clock back decades. I don't know if he's going to be able to hold the House together to get these bills through. And, you know, without these bills being approved, the money's not going to be there to help fund these wars. I've just very glad we're right down in the South. You know, nobody really cares too much about us. And Cyril can come back from Paris, and that's the last we'll hear of him for this year, one hopes.
Look, we're talking now about Mike Johnson, who's the new Speaker of the House, was elected late last week, filled this role. If you can remember, there was a bunch of failed attempts by other individuals. And this is now kind of the status quo that has now existed. Dawn, this reminds me again of Teddy Roosevelt. You know, he entered the Second World War reluctantly. And he did so because, quite frankly, he had no choice. You know, Pearl Harbor had happened. And before that, they really stood on the sidelines and really were the support vehicle for, you know, for other countries. They knew what was happening in the United Kingdom. They were prepared to back, you know, the United Kingdom with arms and with money and with all the other things. But that's kind of where they stopped. But when the war ended up on their doorstep, they were forced into a position. And that's a little bit, for me, where the Americans are perhaps at this stage. It's easy to talk about Ukraine. Do we want to support it? Don't we want to support it? Do we think it's the right thing? Do we think it's the wrong thing? There's lots of political debate around this. But perhaps this whole thing happening in Israel and Gaza and us seeing more and more military assets going to the area, perhaps this forces the Americans, not only their hand, but forces the public opinion around how they should be acting in a more divided world. That we'll only know in time, right? So I think Mike Johnson's going to have a tough job, let me put it to you this way. I think the next 5 years are going to be tough in the world economy, and I think it's going to be tough as far as from a political perspective and just as the world tries and finds a new way around it.
Never mind the next 5 years. I think Mike Johnson will be very lucky to last until the elections, the presidential elections, which also have some House and Senate elections thrown in with them, and at which time the Republicans could very well lose the House. Then he no longer has a job. I don't envy people like President Biden, who are, for all intents and purposes, trying to do the right thing and making promises of money and arms and that, but not being able to release the money purely because anything that Biden says, they're going to say the opposite, whether they believe in it or not.
Yeah, yeah. And then look, in the midst of all of that, we have an economic issue busy taking root globally. rates that have gone up. We've spoken about that ad nauseum. The looming U.S. recession that might very well occur in 2024. As a matter of fact, Dawn, I'm listening to quite a few analysts saying, listen, perhaps we're already in that recession. Perhaps it's already happened. The data just not showing it yet, but perhaps we're already in portions of it actually already starting to contract. And you're going to start seeing the net effect of that only next year. I think you've got a great visual actually showing what GDP growth was like just before the onset of a recession through different time periods in the past. And I think that's telling because that shows you how backward-looking central banks really are when it comes to data. They're not really forward-looking. And I remember Alan Greenspan being forced on this point, and he said, don't expect me to look at forward-looking data because it's not reality. I have to apply my mind to reality, and reality is backward-looking data. I can't be expected to see the future, because then I just become a speculator with the rest of the market participants. And this is just the place that central banks are finding itself. And in the wake of that, Dawn, we've got an earnings season that's busy rolling through at this stage. GDP in the US, and we'll get to earnings now, but GDP in the US for the second quarter came in at 4.8% year on year. It's not a bad number, right? I mean, if you know, rates are kind of at 4.85%, that's not a bad number.
You can believe it, Kobe. I think in last week's newsletter, I highlighted how the statistics, the US statistics, are inclined to, you know, sort of rejig the numbers every month. Yeah. And usually, you know, rejig them down and this kind of thing. So, I mean, as much as we sort of completely discount anything, any statistic that's coming out of China, it's almost getting to the same place with the US. It's like,
yes, you know,
that those numbers are really being manipulated according to an agenda.
Yep.
Then a couple of months down the line, because everybody's, you know, got the, you know, attention span of a newt.
Yeah.
They get about it and they just quietly rejig the figures and they don't look quite as rosy as they did. So, you know, more than anything else, I think what it is that particularly for our clients and our clients that are investing with us, we don't have the privilege of using hindsight. We can't, as when we invest, we as investors, as asset managers, have to look into the future and see where is this going. And as we've talked about a lot over the last few months, there are more asset classes that we can start using to do it. It isn't all just about the stock exchange. It isn't all just about the European stock exchange. Bonds start to become more interesting. Property is still a fraught class. China is still, we watch it, but it's still a fraught asset. So there's so much confusion out there that, you know, you people like yourself as an asset manager have to spend the whole time trying to sort of say, where is this going? It's like sort of walking in a dense fog. And the problem with walking in a dense fog is that occasionally you end up walking off a cliff.
This is the thing that makes this job so hard at this stage. And I'm quite frankly, I think it's going to be hard for the ensuing 5 to 10 years that are ahead, because we've got all these geopolitical things that are busy playing itself out. Within the confines of those, you have inflation that could spike up and spike down all the time, because you just don't have that big globalized world with supply chains across the world trying to drive inflation lower and lower all the time. And then you have a rejigging of the world economy. Who is who in the political zoo, so to speak? Who is going to make the rules? Who's going to enforce those rules? And in what jurisdictions and what are those things going to look like? And then there's all these skirmishes that are happening, that we've got one in Ukraine now, we've got one in Israel, across the border into Gaza. So you've got all of these things playing itself out. And Dawn, look, this is something that at Rexlarm we've preached about for the last 9 years. Stop worrying about benchmarks and stop worrying about the trying to achieve specific rigidity as far as asset allocations are concerned, and be more focused on outcomes. What is the outcome that one wants to achieve? And what is the most reliable way in order to achieve that outcome? Now, generally speaking, and I write quite a lot, and for anybody listening today, go through the newsletter, because I write about 60-40 portfolios. Now, 60-40 portfolios was the buzz right through the 80s and the 1990s and even the 2000s. Put 60% of your money in equities, 40% into bonds. You get diversification. The two are negatively correlated. And quite frankly, you get a much smoother ride upwards. And quite frankly, it worked for decades. It was an absolutely fantastic rule to try and keep yourself attuned to. There's ETFs with 60-40 balances. Everybody knows 60-40. It's taught in universities, finance courses. It is the status quo. It is the mindset of the day. That has left you sorely lacking since interest rates have started going up across the world. As these rates have risen, you've seen bonds lose value. In this week's newsletter, I actually show you how 20-year bonds have actually lost their luster through just a very long-term chart as far as bond yields are concerned. And if you have a look at those, you'll see by how much 20-year bonds have actually retraced. We're talking about a 50% retracement in price for 20-year bonds. Now, that's a large burden to bear in an overall portfolio. Whereas if you become outcome-based, you no longer hold on to these rules. Then you're no longer anchored to these rules. You're asking, what is the outcome and what's the best way to achieve that outcome? And you're starting with a blank page. And that is probably a better way to try and infiltrate and try and understand the world that we're busy moving into, rather than saying, listen here, actually, I should just be, this should be the balance. You know, put money with these managers, put money with those managers and just maintain the balance. It should be fine long term.
Kobe, I think this brings us back to, you know, what our investment philosophy is at Rexulam Invest, because what we do is advice led.
Yes, correct.
You know, you don't just take somebody off the street and says, here, I've got, you know, 5 million invested. It's all outcomes based. And the way that you achieve those outcomes is for an advisor to sit with a client and say, what are those outcomes for you? What do they look like? What are the implications of them? What are the time frames? You know, what are the implications of moving from one sort of type of investment to another? You know, sometimes there's capital gains tax and switching from conserving money to using it as an income. There are all sorts of factors, and all will reflect on that outcome. And you know, this is where what we do is really quite different, because as you say, we, you know, the 60-40 and as an advisor sort of, and watching other advisors out there, particularly ones that perhaps are newer at this and, you know, not being around the block as much or don't have as much qualifications, is that it's very scary for a lot of advisors to try and navigate this, right?
Absolutely.
I have difficulty enough. Now you've got an advisor who they're now trying to do something in the best interest of their clients. They know what the outcome is, and their only choice is to go and use ETFs and funds and this kind of thing. And they know that if they go by old standards of 60-40 and this kind of thing, they can't get into trouble, right?
Yeah.
They're covering their own ass in many respects when they're doing this. It's not that they are deliberately sort of putting you into these things knowing that they're not going to fail. They know that it's completely uncertain out there, but this, you know, it might just get you to the end of the line. It's, you know, it's not so much laziness as perhaps not really understanding how this whole thing works and not having access to the products that can do it.
And Dawn, I think, I mean, speaking about asset management, you know, I think part of the problem that we've faced in the past is, you know, in a world of plenty, when asset prices are just rising, then it becomes easy to have to say, well, how's my horse looking like relative to other horses in the race? And am I number one? Am I number two, or am I at the back of the pack? It's the peer group review. Where am I stacked up against the rest? But that's in a world where all asset prices are rising. We're moving into a world where not all asset prices are rising because the world economy around us is changing. The political landscape is changing across the whole globe. And we don't know what those ramifications are going to be in a decade from now. We have no idea. We might be in World War III. We might not. We might be in a world where there's 20 or 30 different skirmishes happening across the world, smaller wars, but that is dividing the world in such a way that we now have two very distinct trade blocks across the world. That has implications for absolutely everything that we do. So I think the judge of a good asset manager and the judge of good investment management is the understanding in the future of the outcome and not losing money. That is going to become almost the yardstick of the future, and asking, how do I not lose money, even though I might be wrong about not getting the very best return that everybody else is getting out there? That's no longer that important. What's more important is not losing money, because the chances for you to lose money has become so much more.
You know, Kobe, whenever I speak to clients about their portfolios, particularly when it comes to income generating portfolios, you know, once you get into retirement, which a lot of our clients are in that sort of ballpark.
Sure.
If they're not coming into it, they're actually in it, is to actually understand that what we are trying to do is reduce their stress long term.
Mm.
And stress is not reserved for retirees, but it's all the more important with retirees because they have not got new money coming in, right? So this is the pot that they've been building up the holding, and you can't make a mistake. You know, if you're 20 and you make a mistake, you're going to be earning for the next 30 years. That's fine. You can rectify that mistake. Once you get to the age of 55, you have to start being a lot more prudent in what you do. And what we tend to do is have an income or a portfolio that is sustainable and it is certain, so that you are not saying, okay, it's dividends, right? You're getting your stuff from dividends and they'll come in once every six months. And occasionally a company might skip their dividend and then you are in a load of trouble, right? This is no, you want 50,000 Rand a month, 100,000 Rand a month. This is how we build it, so that for every single month, that is what you'll get. And annually we can reassess that, because we're going to be putting money back into the pot from what we get. So you've got that certainty and that capital preservation that, you know, we watch that. I mean, I certainly, as an advisor, when I'm doing my reviews with my client and with the bigger clients, of course, that's on a monthly basis, is that you watch that capital preservation. As soon as that capital preservation starts to come under pressure, which is usually with a retiree caused by taking too much of a drawdown, but as soon as that
excess capital
pressure, it puts up a red flag for both you and I. And there are things
absolutely.
Can do as an asset manager, and there are things that I can do. And this is a world away from what you know a normal advisor would do, but is extremely powerful in terms of taking away that financial stress, the stress of hell is what if this money runs out.
That's the world that's busy evolving ahead of us. What is the saying, Dawn? It says, may I live in interesting times. And I believe we are living in interesting times. That's week number 43 for our podcast with myself, Kirby Lakhranji, and with Dawn Riddler. Head over to the newsletter, go and read all about what we spoke about today, and reach out to us. If you want to chat about any of these things, or you want to chat about your portfolio, feel free to do so. Thank you for listening.